thank you very much. I appreciated my wife starting that. I was wondering what was going to happen. So, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me just note that this is going to be on C-SPAN, so we do have some time constraints, et cetera. So I will just note that to all of you before we get started. But we are so glad to have all of you here, and welcome to the Chancellor's Lecture of the first Chancellor's Lecture of the 2004-2005 season. As Chancellor, of course, I am granted, and indeed I grant myself, the privilege and honor of introducing our distinguished speaker. But I also find honor in the fact that through these Chancellor's Lectures, Vanderbilt is able to increase our ability to serve the communities to which we belong. And several of you noted that to me this evening, for which I am deeply appreciative. Of course, we're here to serve our students, our faculty, by bringing speakers whose insights will integrate with and transform the insights we exchange in our classrooms, but also to serve Nashville by offering speakers who are influential and shaping whose ideas, of course, are provocative. So I take great pride and pleasure this evening in introducing Ken Paulson, editor of USA Today. Tonight's lecture will be Ken's first public address since he assumed the editorship of USA Today. And this evening is also significant as a return to Nashville for Ken, who is former senior vice president of the Freedom Forum and former executive director of the First Amendment Center. As you might surmise, Ken Paulson is an expert in First Amendment issues, particularly those pertaining to Supreme Court decisions, media and journalism, free speech and press, and free expression in the arts. Throughout his career, Ken has drawn on his background as both journalist and a lawyer in order to promote understanding of the First Amendment. His syndicated column, Inside the First Amendment, is published in newspapers around the nation, and Speaking Freely, his weekly half-hour public television program about the First Amendment and the arts, has a nationwide audience. Ken Paulson became the sixth editor of USA Today when he took over the editorship of the paper after it was rocked by a plagiarism scandal. His task was, of course, to repair USA Today's credibility and to protect its integrity. Tonight, Ken will discuss the ethical dilemmas facing the field of journalism and issue a challenge to the American media to remind them of the critical role journalism plays in the protection and preservation of our democracy. Our culture is paying renewed attention to the editorial voices of mass media, attuning to them in order to listen and to observe and analyze how publications and broadcasts to their editorial stances through the stories they choose to run and the settings in which they place them can influence and turn the tide of national discourse. That such power of influence is wielded in a way that is ethically sound and intended to serve the public as an unobstructed channel of information is vitally important to the health of our democracy. There have been few moments in our recent history more appropriate for a lecture such as this one. Ladies and gentlemen, I am absolutely delighted to welcome to our podium Ken Paulson, editor of USA Today.
Thank you, Chancellor, for that gracious introduction. It truly is an honor and a privilege to be here with you tonight on this campus that I've come to both love and respect. My 7 years at the First Amendment Center were among the most rewarding of my life, both in terms of the work I did and the friends I made. It's great to see so many of you here tonight. I had the great good fortune during my very first month at Vanderbilt to meet two other relative newcomers, Mike Schoenfeld, who is now the Vice Chancellor for Public Affairs, and Kent Siverud, who's the Dean of the Law School. They quickly became partners, allies, and friends in the truest sense. My work at the First Amendment Center also gave me the chance and opportunity to work closely with Chancellor Joe Wyatt and more recently with Chancellor Gee, both of whom gave extraordinary support to the work of the Freedom Forum and the First Amendment Center. I also see in the audience tonight a good number of my friends and colleagues from the First Amendment Center. The founder of that center, John Siegenthaler, couldn't join us today, but I must tell you, he is one of those rare human beings about whom so many positive things have been written and said, and yet somehow they are not overstated at all. John Siegenthaler is the real thing. One of the great benefits of working with John, of course, is that he has a few years on me, and he had a habit of referring to me as his young partner. Well, as you can tell, I'm not that young. I am old enough to remember when telephones had rotary dials and cords. I'm old enough to remember when pitchers in the American League actually picked up a bat now and then. And I'm old enough to remember when multimedia meant your family had both a television set and a radio. I'm also old enough to remember when members of the press were the good guys. I actually recall a time when books and magazines and movies and television shows would depict journalists as something other than scandal mongers. For example, as a kid, I loved comic books. And who was Superman when he wasn't leaping tall buildings in a single bound? He was Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, who, by the way, helped fight a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. Some of you may even remember the Green Hornet. You know, when he wasn't fighting crime, he was Britt Reed, a crusading newspaper publisher. Of course, some of our fictional heroes didn't fight crime on the side. They fought in the columns of the daily newspaper. I have a poster from a 1952 movie called Deadline USA hanging in my office at USA Today. Just a show of hands, how many of you have seen that movie? It did that well at the box office, too, in 1952. But it's a kind of a Bogart classic, and it's a story of the managing editor of a New York newspaper, played by Humphrey Bogart, who takes in the mob. And the title of my lecture tonight, As Long as One Newspaper Will Print the Truth, is actually a line from the dramatic closing moments of that Bogart movie. Of course, the real heroes of American journalism are not fictional. They are the courageous men and women who have used freedom of the press to make a real difference in American society. They are the journalists who reported about racial injustice during the height of the civil rights movement, helping to fuel freedom through the power of words and images. They're the war correspondents and photographers who risked their lives to tell the stories of our men and women in uniform and their battles in defense of liberty. They're the muckrakers, investigative reporters who have challenged the powerful and courageously reported stories that otherwise would have gone untold. You know, it's also important to remember that many of those journalists who have made a difference were of diverse races and faiths, demanding equality under a constitution that was drafted by wealthy white men, a constitution that began "We the People," but did not truly reflect all of the people. From the 19th century founding of the Cherokee Phoenix, to the abolitionist writings of Frederick Douglass, to the anti-lynching crusade of Ida B. Wells, from the groundbreaking work of Ignacio Elizondo, a pioneer of Spanish language publishing, to the work of William Hosokawa, who wrote hard-hitting articles while interned at a camp for Japanese Americans in World War II. We've seen literally centuries of news stories that have made a difference. So if we can point to heroic efforts by America's journalists throughout our history, why is it that today the news media are held in such low regard? How do we come to this? I have to tell you, I had a good number of friends walk up to me at the reception and say, so how's it going? What's new? What have you found out? I think the greatest single surprise I've had at USA Today is how polarized this nation is. And I work for a newspaper that really, truly tries to play it down the middle. And yet every day I pick up my mail and it will say, you are clearly part of the Bush re-election campaign, or you're a communist in lockstep with John Kerry. Same day, same newspaper. And that has been a great surprise to me. The amount of anger out there, the amount of division out there. Just when did we stop thinking about the press as being defenders of the downtrodden and instead as being politically partisan? Now, some say you can trace it back to Vice President Spiro Agnew, who in 1969 decided to take on critical press directly. The Vietnam War was incredibly unpopular, and there was a lot of negative and unflattering coverage of the Nixon White House. Agnew went on the offensive, decrying the press as the liberal establishment and describing critics as nattering nabobs of negativism. Now, for the younger people in the audience, that may sound like a strange phrase. Frankly, in 1969, it sounded pretty bizarre. But I suspect that 35 years from now, there may be people scratching their heads at the phrase, I call them economic girly men. Agnew's strategy proved to be very effective. Where once politicians and people in power would walk gingerly around newspaper editors and publishers, eager to seek their endorsement, the new strategy was to dismiss the press. What better way to nullify the watchdog role of the free press than to convince your supporters that there's no need to pay attention to the barking because the watchdog is rabid? Respect for the press has been in steady decline for decades. And to be clear, it's not just the politicians who are administering the beating. By and large, America's news media have done it to themselves. Much of our industry is driven by the bottom line, yet covering the community or the nation requires significant resources, and it can't be done on the cheap. By and large, the employees of America's newsrooms are not highly paid, and very few news organizations today have as many people as they had 10 years ago. In addition, the polarization of America is now reflected daily in our media. When cable television producers discovered they could build a modest audience at little cost by having two pundits yell at each other, that became a big part of our culture. While working at the First Amendment Center, I often received phone calls from bookers, and they would say, "Did you see the new Supreme Court decision?" And they would go on to say, "Aren't you outraged by what the Supreme Court has just done?" And I would think for a moment, I'd say, "Well, you know, there's some pluses to that decision, and there are some negatives to that decision." And then there'd be silence on the phone, and they'd say, "Well, do you have the phone number of somebody who's really angry about this?" Somehow, America's news media have become intent on generating heat rather than light, and that's a shame. It's also taking a toll. According to surveys done by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, just 59% of Americans say they believe what they read in newspapers, down from 80% in 1985. Another Pew study indicates that 59% of Americans believe journalists don't care about inaccuracies. On top of that, newspapers, arguably the most in-depth daily source of news and information in a free society, are losing ground to their media rivals. In 1978, the year I entered the newspaper business, there were 1,756 daily newspapers. Today, there are 300 fewer, and most newspapers are seeing significant annual circulation declines. So given all of that, why in the world did I leave my rewarding job at Vanderbilt University to go back into the newspaper business? Because I still believe in a free press. You know, for the last 7 years, I've traveled all over this country, talked to people about the First Amendment. Five freedoms we take for granted day in and day out. Surveys indicate that only 1% of Americans can name the five freedoms of the First Amendment. I know you're all cataloging them right now. The majority, if you ask them, can come up with just one freedom, typically freedom of speech. First Amendment Center surveys also indicate that almost a third of Americans believe the First Amendment gives us too much freedom. By the way, that number hit a high of 49%. Half of Americans said the First Amendment gives us too much freedom shortly after the tragic events of 9/11. Literally, millions of Americans changed their mind about freedom versus security after that tragic day. Literally, time and again, Americans see the First Amendment as protecting too much speech and free expression, giving America's news media too much license, too much freedom. And those are unsettling findings. It appears that most Americans have lost sight of the purpose of the First Amendment and the importance of a free press in American society. You know, a lot of us have forgotten that this nation was essentially founded on the run. People shot at each other at Lexington and Concord, and we had to invent a government on the run. And they didn't have an elaborate plan. You know, they just had to do what they could. And in time, they came up with the Articles of Confederation. Very weak, laid-back form of government, preserved the powers for the states. And it didn't work very well for us in the 1780s. This very young country was very vulnerable. And our economy was in bad shape. There was a question about external pressures on the country. Could we be invaded? Would we survive? And so the Federalists came up with a plan. They said, you know what we really need is a strong central government. And they developed a blueprint and something called the U.S. Constitution. And they took it to the people, took it to the states and said, here's our plan, legislative branch, executive branch, judicial branch, it'll work really well, trust us. And the American people, surprisingly, didn't embrace the U.S. Constitution immediately. Several states refused to because they were afraid of a strong central government. They'd had that before, it's called a king. And they didn't want to give anyone that much power. But there was time to discuss and explore it and try to chart a path of progress for this new nation. And in time, the American people, in effect, came back through their representatives with a message. Fine, we'll give you the kind of government you're looking for. But you've got to get us some promises. You've got to give us some guarantees. You've got to promise us that this new and powerful government will not put soldiers in our homes during peacetime. That it won't subject us to unreasonable search and seizure. That if we're accused of a crime, we get a jury trial. That the guys running around with guns, our well-regulated state militia, we get to keep and bear arms. And perhaps most important, we want to promise that we can say whatever we want, that we can worship the God of our choice, that if we're not happy with the way things are going, we can petition this government for change and assemble together in the town square and raise our voices if we're concerned about the direction of things. And on top of that, we'd like to be able to write whatever we want. And we want a free press to keep an eye on the people in power. Of course, that set of demands was incorporated into the Bill of Rights. A deal was cut, a contract between the government and the people. A new nation which balanced the power of the people with the power of the government. It's amazing, really, when you think that the First Amendment was a demand by the American people, and now about a third of us say, take it back, cut it back, reduce it. Today, many Americans will tell you they resent the news media because they are arrogant and reckless. Some would say they even seem determined to bring down a president. And yet the actions of the news media pale by comparison to the practices in place a little more than 200 years ago. At this nation's birth, newspaper was started primarily for one purpose, to attack a political rival. There was no advertising revenue from Home Depot in those days. So newspapers were biased, and they were brutal, and they attacked enemies of whoever happened to be publishing the paper. They were particularly tough on the nation's leaders. The first president to bristle at unfair and aggressive press coverage was the first president. And despite the reckless and aggressive reporting of the time, that first generation of Americans recognized the importance of those critical voices. With the support of the American people, the founding fathers created a new and powerful government, but also guaranteed the kind of a free press that would take a stand for liberty and justice, and that mission has not changed. Is there a liberal bias in America's newsrooms? Well, I've known quite a few reporters who, over beers, will share a liberal perspective. But I also know I can count on one hand the number of newspaper publishers or owners I would describe as liberal. Actually, just John Siegenthaler. I have to tell you that after almost two decades of working in America's newsrooms, I have never heard a reporter or editor say anything about tailoring news content to favor one political party or another, one candidate or another. You know, this is a profession that attracts the highly skeptical, but it also attracts the highly principled. The real bias in America's newsrooms is not for or against a political party. It's against the people in power. And of course, that's the way it's always been, looking out for the American people, challenging those in charge to defend their use or abuse of public office. As for America's newspapers, I'm still bullish. Newspapers occupy a unique role in the media landscape. In fact, I think the greatest single mistake the newspaper business did was to stop calling itself the press. Instead, they described themselves as being part of the news media. You know, I like to think I'm part of the media landscape, but I'm a newspaper man. And USA Today has a newspaper and a website, and they all reflect values that are different from the rest of the media. Newspapers occupy a unique role. Newspapers have strengths that other media can't match. You know, local television newscasts can be lively, entertaining, and informative, but ratings are driven by the visual and the violent. The only time you'll get significant coverage of City Hall on a local television newscast is if someone accidentally drives their car into it. The internet is extraordinary, but it's a kind of medium that allows us to surf for information, only Googling subjects that we care about, only searching for stories that reflect our interests. Newspapers, on the other hand, encourage us to work page by page through the world, exposing us to stories, subjects, countries, and philosophies that otherwise we'd never have read about. Radio has a grand tradition, but it tends to be fragmented, and it's tough to convey a sense of community through the broadcast of a single station. Increasingly, of course, radio is also dominated by confrontational talk, the same kind of thing that plagues cable television. Of course, newspapers lose the timeliness battle because of their publishing cycle, but they gain something more in terms of depth, perspective, and accuracy. If you don't need to rush your report on air or online, you can reflect upon it, refine your content, and hopefully take the time to get it right. Now, I'm a realist. I recognize that there's a younger generation of Americans who are unlikely to turn to newsprint as their primary information source. But I also believe that the content of American newspapers can and will successfully migrate to emerging media, including media we haven't seen yet, with integrity and commitment intact. I believe that America's newspapers, even in their tree-dependent form, can survive and thrive if we remember to honor the core principles of our profession. We simply have to work harder to rebuild trust with our readers. One step to rebuilding trust is to rein in confidential sources. As a young police reporter in Fort Myers, Florida, I was so green. And I would go and talk to the police, and I'd say, well, what's going on here? Can you tell me what's really going on? And they'd all say, can we go off the record? And I'd look at them blankly, and I'd say, well, why would I want to do that? Because if you tell me that and it's off the record, I can't use it. And they inevitably would tell me, because I was such a clueless fool, that I didn't understand how the game was played, and they really wanted to talk anyway. But it didn't make sense to me. Why would you ever go off the record? Well, obviously, covering the Fort Myers Police Department is a different game than covering Washington, and the culture of confidentiality is everywhere. Today's sources routinely ask for anonymity in exchange for information. Almost every major story involving politics or government policy has multiple references to sources who provide the information with the understanding that they would not be identified. Of course, there was the use and abuse of confidential sources, more precisely non-existent sources, that led to embarrassment at USA Today this year. In recent months, we've taken several steps to try to ensure that nothing like this happens again. USA Today's new policy says that anonymous sources may not be used in the newspaper unless the identity of the source is known to a managing editor, a very senior job in the newsroom. And then that managing editor has to make an independent decision that the value of the information outweighs the potential damage to our credibility. Now, some of you who have been in journalism courses or actually worked in the field are familiar with the who, what, where, when, and why of a news story. Our news stories will not be as credible as they should until we do a better job in the identity and the motives of the who. Another way to regain trust is to improve our accuracy. I have to tell you, my 7 years at the First Amendment Center was an eye-opener. I found myself interviewed on First Amendment issues 2 and 3 times a week, and in all candor, only about half of those articles got all the details right. I found myself misquoted or misunderstood in about a fourth of them. And I suspect that the people in this room and people who don't talk to the press for a living have similar experiences. The American people will not trust your reporting on Iraq if you can't correctly spell the name of the next-door neighbor. In fairness, gathering and publishing news and information is done on the run with incredible time pressures, but we still have to work harder to get the details right. You know, one of the key elements of that Jason Blair plagiarism case was that some sources said they couldn't get through to the New York Times to tell them their concerns about this reporter's practices. That can't happen. At USA Today, you'll now find on our editorial page a photo of Brent Jones, a friendly-looking gentleman. He's our reader editor. Readers with questions, comments, or concerns are invited to write him at accuracy@usatoday.com. And since launching that feature, our feedback from readers has doubled. Now, I like to think we're not like making twice as many errors now. I actually got an email today from somebody saying, I'm sick of seeing Brent Jones' picture in the paper. And Brent took that rather personally. By the way, the reader editor meets with me every morning for a brief conversation about what we have heard from readers in the previous 24 hours. Every day, I begin my day and say, what do the readers say? If anyone suggests that a reporter has violated professional ethics, we look into it immediately. We have a standards editor who reviews our practices and tells us every day if we've lived up to our promises to our readers. And she keeps us as honest as she can. You cannot let things fester. We also try to do some outreach, sending letters each week to a cross-section of people who have been interviewed in our newspaper. The questionnaire basically asks whether the story and quotes were accurate, and it can actually be a pretty encouraging exercise because you get a lot of positive feedback that way, but it's just one more way to make sure we get things right. Another key to regaining trust is to ensure that our newsrooms reflect the communities we serve. Of course, that means, in part, hiring more journalists of color, a goal being addressed ambitiously by the Freedom Forum's Diversity Institute here on campus. It also means building a newsroom full of people with all kinds of diverse backgrounds, experiences, interests, age, viewpoints. It's a positive thing when the tastes of your staff run from Wayne Newton to the Fountains of Wayne. And you know, that's actually that sentence, exactly half the audience got half of that. In addition to more closely reflecting our communities, journalists can stand to be a little bit more involved. For years, it was the culture of our industry not to participate, not to volunteer, not to be on boards, all in the interest of preserving as much independence as possible. We can see where that's led us. We're so independent, we're hermetically sealed. We can see what happens, but we can't always tell you why. We can't afford to lose touch like that. We can help rebuild trust if we use that diverse newsroom to truly reflect all that's going on in our communities, the positive and the negative. There's a cliche in television that if it bleeds, it leads, but that same tendency towards the negative is found in print as well. We absolutely need to report what's gone wrong, but we also need to report on progress and celebrate successes. For example, a lot of coverage of Iraq tends to center on explosions and setbacks, and we have an obligation to communicate just how rough a road we are facing in trying to rebuild the country. But I did challenge my staff to try to come up with additional ways to give readers some real insight into what lies beyond the explosions. They've come up with a new feature that we've been running the past few weeks called Inside Iraq. And it's a weekly progress report. And in that spot, we've done stories on how the mail service is actually up and running again, how much progress Iraq's schools have made in recent months, along with a story that said Iraqis had hoped for greater travel opportunities, but those have not materialized. It's not about happy news. It's about reflecting the reality of daily life in Iraq. Another way to rebuild trust is by approaching stories with a clear slate and an open mind. One of the most disconcerting things about the way journalists go about their business, many of them, is that there's a tendency to approach stories with a preconceived notion. During the interviews I've experienced both at the First Amendment Center and at USA Today, more times than not, I felt that the reporter was coming to me with a thesis and was just looking for some quotes for me that would support it. They weren't acting in bad faith, but it was almost a sense that they thought they knew the truth and just needed me to play along in fleshing it out. And I can't think of a more unfortunate example of that than the events of the past 2 weeks involving 60 Minutes and the purported National Guard documents. You know, we've all had a lot of coverage of this, extensive coverage in yesterday's USA Today. I've actually seen some television talk shows where commentators seem to enjoy 60 Minutes' plight. Let's be clear about this. A blow to 60 Minutes is a blow to the long-term credibility of all news organizations. Yes, many of us did some digging and raised doubts about the documents while 60 Minutes was still clinging to the story. But the truth is that virtually all of the major media, including USA Today, were initially blinded by the fact that 60 Minutes had a sterling reputation and that the White House, which has been known to challenge reporters' stories, didn't contest the authenticity of the documents. It wasn't until bloggers on the internet began raising questions about typefaces that it occurred to anyone that this story might be heading south. It is the wonder of the internet that it encompasses every facet of world knowledge, including apparently a fair share of people who know arcane typefaces and the history of typewriters in America. When they began asking questions, the press took a closer look. In turn, a number of major news organizations, including USA Today, began reporting on the doubts. And in our case, we ended up picking up two experts, hiring someone to take a look, who came back and said he thought they were forgeries. But the bottom line is that this was a classic example of bringing a preconceived notion to a story and not providing enough scrutiny from the outset. Finally, one more way to rebuild trust is to address the culture of secrecy that has taken hold in government offices across the country, and not just in state and local government, but particularly in the nation's capital. It is now routine for government officials, men and women on the public payroll, to brief reporters about the nation's business while insisting that no one use their names. It occurs every day in Washington. An official will come out to brief the press about American policy, about plans, about what's being done with taxpayer dollars, and condition that conversation on their own anonymity. People on the public payroll. Now, the Associated Press and USA Today both consistently object to these ground rules, and the typical response is, well, if you don't like the rules, you can leave. Daniel Okrent, the public editor at the New York Times, wrote a column in June calling on the editors of the five largest papers in America to take a stand and simply refuse to write about these briefings. He publicly challenged each of us to respond. I didn't realize then that I'm supposed to be above such things, so I wrote him back. I told him that we, in fact, had been taking a stand, but we felt that we couldn't walk out of the room. There was important information there, and we owed it to our readers to stay. Our primary obligation, after all, is to keep our readers fully informed. I did suggest to him that he might want to rephrase his challenge to America's newspapers and news organizations. Instead of walking out, When are we ready to speak up and demand this practice end? You know, 2 months later, Okrent ran a follow-up column saying that of the nation's 5 largest newspapers, only USA Today bothered to respond. The culture of confidentiality is seductive but damaging. It's time that both the press and the public demand that people on the public payroll stay on the public record. You know, I mentioned that Humphrey Bogart movie at the outset, and there's a closing scene that I've seen dozens of times and it never fails to move me. Bogart is standing in the press room, and he takes a phone call from a mobster, and the mobster warns him not to publish the story. And the mobster says, "Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off me. Don't print that story. If not tonight, then tomorrow. Maybe next week, maybe next year. But sooner or later, you'll catch it. Listen to me. Print that story and you're a dead man." Picture Bogart. He responds, "It's not just me anymore," speaking as the managing editor of this metropolitan newspaper. "You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished." From the background, you hear the noise of newspaper presses rolling. The mobster yells, "That noise, what's that racket?" Bogart's response, "That's the press, baby. The press, and there's nothing you can do about it." I still get chills. At that moment in the movie, you see the presses rolling, and so help me, the battle hymn of the Republic. They don't make them like that anymore. They also don't make journalists like that anymore, and there's not a lot of Bogart in the news business these days. Of course, he would have quit anyway when they told him he had to stop smoking and swearing. You know, I heard an NPR report the other day in which a commentator suggested that this is a nation, of course, that's divided between red and blue states, and increasingly Americans want their media to be red or blue media. They want to see their own biases reflected in the news media. Red media, blue media. It may be overexposure to Humphrey Bogart, but I continue to believe that America's newspapers can be the red, white, and blue media. When we do our jobs the right way, when we strive every day to publish reports of integrity and balance, when we ask the tough questions, when we fight to keep the public's business public, and when we provide the kind of thorough and balanced reporting that is the lifeblood of a democracy, we fulfill our promise to that first generation of Americans who believe that the very best way to guarantee a democracy was a free and vigorous press. These are critical times for the men and women of the American newspaper industry. There's no question that we've lost ground and that many Americans don't distinguish between our work and tabloid newspapers and sensationalistic television shows. The only way to turn that around is to publish newspapers every day with passion, commitment, and integrity. If the naysayers are right, if newspapers are on their way out, and we are, in fact, in the final decades of this glorious business, let's go out the right way. Let's give our readers a daily report that we're proud of, living up to our First Amendment responsibilities and embracing the values we cherish most. Let's give them a little Bogart and a whole lot of Thomas Jefferson. There's work to do. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll be happy to take some questions if they're not too difficult. Yes, sir.
What do you mean by accuracy in the press when a reporter accurately quotes a speaker who is all wrong in what he's saying, and the reporter never mentions the error of the speaker?
You need to give me more details.
Should know to be able to contradict what a speaker says, and even if it's a high official of the government.
Well, those of you who are watching on C-SPAN can't hear the question, and essentially it's a question about gross incompetence in the newspaper business, I suppose. How can we talk about accuracy if somebody gets a speech terribly wrong, doesn't pay any attention, doesn't get the facts right?
The quote is correct, but the quote is all wrong.
The quote is correct.
That is, he quotes the speaker correctly, but the speaker is speaking inaccurate information.
So you're suggesting that it's the responsibility of the media to actually challenge what the speaker is saying? It's an interesting point, and I think it applies to different stories in different circumstances. For example, someone's going to give a speech about gardening. I'm not sure that that reporter has to be an expert in gardening, but certainly one of the things we're trying to do at USA Today now is when a candidate for president makes a speech and makes a statement, we're also trying to do an accuracy check whenever we possibly can. I think it's an important component. So it's something that takes a lot of time and resources, but it would build trust. You're absolutely right. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Do you believe that in time of war, truth is the first casualty?
Do I believe that in time of war, truth is the first casualty? That's not original to you, is that? I think there is tremendous pressure on all our liberties during time of war. You know, when President Bush spoke in the days following September 11th, he said, freedom and fear are at war. And he was absolutely right. But that applies on several levels, and it kind of goes back to the survey results I talked about. You know, people were looking for more security, and they would sort of turn their back on freedom because they're more concerned about their personal preservation than they were about vague principles of liberty, justice, and equality. So I think there's never been more pressure on our civil liberties and our speech and the truth than in wartime. You've seen that in the Civil War. You've seen, you know, FDR, a great president, put Japanese Americans in camps. Again, fear dominated the atmosphere and short-circuited our civil liberties. Yes, sir.
I watched Channel 51, Hardball, last night. Oh. And all the emphasis was on the messenger. Nobody talked about the message. Now, maybe the messenger, you know, they shot the messenger and they didn't relate to the message at all. And the lady who was the typist for this lieutenant colonel said, yes, I think that the documents are not true.
Right.
However, the message within them is, and nobody spoke about that.
Right. This gentleman was making the point that the counterattacks against 60 Minutes dominate the news now, and no one's talking about whether what 60 Minutes reported, that President Bush had gotten preferential treatment. No one even explores whether that's true or not, I think is your point. And I think, you know, when I look at this coverage of this campaign, and hey, I'm the editor of a national newspaper, so I bear some responsibility for this. I'm stunned that we are writing so little about 2004 and beyond. We're covering Vietnam very well. And yet we know that this heat, rather than light, is driving ratings and driving talk, and we got to fix that. I think this is a country that is as divided as it has ever been, and I think there's a role for the press to begin to build some understanding and some consensus. We don't have to pit each other against each other all the time. We can find some common ground and try to build a better society. As to your point about why are we not covering the underlying story, I think people have. I think they've tried to, and I think 60 Minutes certainly thought it was on the right track for a while. It didn't work out for them. Yes?
I was wondering, you know, true or false, like that a plane in, you know, a hangar is being painted with a Kerry Edwards decal, or that an official is, you know, allegedly outed, or that a presidential candidate is allegedly having an affair?
Well, as somebody who ran the First Amendment Center, I'm pretty excited about all that free speech going around. And I think it's a very healthy thing when citizens are engaged. I mean, I'm astonished at bloggers. I gather they have employment somewhere, but they spend 12 hours a day documenting things, writing things. And I really think this whole 60 Minutes fiasco is a great reminder to traditional media that we're not in this alone anymore, and that you'd better be very, very careful. And you know, a lot of us relied on 60 Minutes, and 60 Minutes allegedly did some checking, and we've yet to find out what they did. But their checking couldn't compare to having the entire world look over their shoulder. So I actually think the blogs are a very positive development, as opposed to chat rooms and some other components of the internet. I think there's a higher level of journalism being practiced on blogs, and I think it's a very healthy thing for society. Yes, sir.
What is your view of these newspapers that put Post-it note advertisements on their front page?
I believe the managing editor of the Tennessean is here tonight. Maybe he'd like to field your question. Okay. I'd rather not have anything stick to the front of my newspaper, thank you. But I will tell you that in the competitive media marketplace we're in, you know, it's newspapers are looking for every advantage, and that is one they're trying to. But I think what you've done is perfect. Tell the people who publish the paper that you'd like a clear front page from now on. Yes?
Fear is certainly a powerful thing that's going on in our country right now, and you alluded to it a few times. What can a newspaper do to try to settle the fear and come down to issues?
Yeah. Well, the question was, what could a newspaper do to sort of address the fear in society? I think information is the number one weapon to defeat fear, and giving people an understanding of what the real risks are of terrorism, what our government's doing to address them. I think people who take the time to read and not just sort of get their news in 20 minutes in the evening on newscasts, they have a better perspective on the world and tend to be less fearful. Candidly, the more information you have, the better off we all are. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
What do you think about the way today that people who are supposed to be reporting the news are becoming the news?
The question is, what do I think about people who are supposed to be reporting the news are becoming the news? Who would be an example of that?
Dan Rather.
Dan Rather. I'm confident that Dan Rather would rather not be the news. He would just wave that right now. There's a culture, and it's surprised me, in which the media attack each other. And I think in a lot of ways it's inside the Beltway story. Americans are disappointed that 60 Minutes failed them, and they're be interested in finding out what's going on, but they don't want to read day after day, you know, demanding apologies and all that. They want information, and they want balance, and the media have become a, you know, it's a celebrity-driven culture now. That has not extended to newspapers. You know, less attractive people go to work for newspapers. We don't have, there's no celebrity involved, but I think it's a troubling trend that there's more focus on the who than who's reporting the news than what's being reported. Yes, sir.
With the lack of young people not reading the newspapers today, have you tried to bring in any humor onto your pages?
Not intentionally. The question, this is almost like Jeopardy, the question for your viewers at home was, have we tried to bring humor into our pages? You know, humor for young people is very risky. You can really entertain 18-year-olds and have everyone over 30 cancel the newspaper. It's an idea I'll take back to USA Today. Yes?
Well, earlier you said resources are even more limited. And, you know, I wonder if you could comment a little bit about some more creative sources of funding. For instance, in Rhode Island, Rhode Island Magazine had, I think, the 20 top lawyers in the community. And as it turns out, you had to pay. Those lawyers actually had to pay to be listed, which was not disclosed. So that was sort of a creative, you know, source of funding. I mean, what about those kinds of ethical issues that also come up for newspapers out there?
That's even more horrifying than those sticky notes on the front of the front page. I have to keep remembering that there are no microphones out there. The question here was about magazines, which do this quite a bit,
print,
come up with strategies to pay the bills by sort of separating, not separating the news from advertising, and you could be named the top 10 decorators, the top 10 lawyers in town in exchange for a small fee. That's horrifying and unacceptable. And all I can tell you is I've never seen a newspaper dabble in that. You just have to shoot straight with your readers. And I think you'd be surprised at how much care is taken to keep the advertising side away from the news side. We're friendly. We're cordial. We talk to the advertising folks. When I was the editor of a paper in Florida, which relied a lot on car dealerships, I had a standing agreement with the advertising director there, which was, we're going to publish the truth about your car dealers. If they're crooks, we'll report that. If they had recalls, we're going to report that. And we are not going to pull our punches. But when they're really, really mad at you, I'll take them to lunch. And that seemed to satisfy a remarkable number of people. But that separation of news and advertising is critical. Without that, the game's over, and you can't trust us anymore. Yes, sir.
What is the daily circulation rate of USA Today?
Daily circulation of USA Today is 2.3 million sold every day and about 6 million read. It's the largest newspaper in America. And if you don't buy it regularly, let's get that up to 3 million, will you, please? Yes.
Two major newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, apologized for their failure in doing the hard questioning and reporting in the lead up to war. What do you think accounts for that failure and the failure of the media in general?
The question had to do, I assume, with the questions about weapons of mass destruction. And I need to make this the final question, so it's a very good one. And the heart of your question is, why did they fail? Boy, that's interesting. Why did they fail to report that there were no weapons of mass destruction? Well, in their defense, our intelligence agencies didn't figure that out either, so it would be hard to do that. You know, at the heart of your question is something I find very fascinating. You know, there's a perception of the press as being liberal and having that bias. But when they surveyed journalists about that period and asked whether they were tough enough on our administration, a majority of journalists said no, they had failed. So you got to figure that out. How is it possible that liberal media went too easy on President Bush, I think that's your point of view. And one theory is that they've been intimidated, or that they are so concerned about balance that they tried hard to report the other side. And you know, people make up their minds about the press, and if you have a negative experience with the press, you'll come away and say, you know, they're all crooks, they're sloppy, they're arrogant, they're inaccurate. But most of them do have good hearts and good heads and try to get it right. And I am certain that the New York Times and the Washington Post were not trying to promote a war. They were trying to get it right. And I think sometimes when you're trying to be really balanced, when you're trying to give the government the benefit of the doubt, because they're telling you we face a serious crisis as Americans, maybe you don't provide as much scrutiny as you should. But I know they both learned from that, and they've both been very straightforward with their readers about what happened and how they plan to avoid it. It's been a real pleasure being with you here tonight. Thank you so much.